You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 21, Down and Out in Paris. Thanks for joining me. We left off last time in early 1795. Napoleon was out of jail and back in uniform. Robespierre and the Jacobin faction had been toppled in the coup of 9 Thermidor the previous year. Napoleon was well known as a Jacobin-aligned general, and many of his closest political patrons had been consumed by the post-coup purge. General Bonaparte himself had escaped physically unscathed, but Thermidor was a serious blow to his career. Napoleon was a political general. Many of his fellow officers saw him purely as a creature of civilian politicians, a backroom intriguer rather than a true soldier. Many believed he did not deserve his rapid promotion to general. I think it's open to debate whether or not that was a fair assessment. It certainly can't be denied that Napoleon courted powerful friends and solicited their help and patronage. In fact, he was totally shameless about it. Throughout his life, in almost all things, Napoleon acted decisively. He never let decorum or modesty stand in the way of doing what he felt needed to be done. This could be a good trait, but it also made him pushy and sometimes even led him to unscrupulousness or ruthlessness. Throughout his life, that way of doing things inevitably rankled people he came into contact with. On the other hand, he really had shown flashes of brilliance, particularly at Toulon and in planning the Saorgio campaign. Napoleon's patrons didn't show him favoritism purely out of a corrupt impulse to reward loyalty. They were desperate to find good officers and genuinely believed he was a military genius whose talents could be of service to the revolution. But, unfairly or not, the word around the French officer corps was that Napoleon was Robespierre's man, and now Robespierre was gone. The new commander of the Army of Italy, General Scherer, considered Bonaparte an untrustworthy schemer, and dismissed him. When the planned expedition to retake Corsica was scrapped in March of 1795, Napoleon was left without an assignment. When new orders arrived, they were not good. Napoleon was to report to the city of Brest in northwestern France, where he would take command of an infantry brigade in the army of General Lazare Hoche, commander of the Republican forces suppressing the Royalist rebellion in the Vendée. This was probably the last assignment Napoleon would have picked for himself. For starters, he had no desire to serve in the Vendée. By early 1795, the rebellion was winding down. Soon after the beginning of the insurgency in 1793, the so-called Catholic and Royal armies numbered in the tens of thousands. They operated like real national armies, marching and fighting in formation and squaring off against Republican forces in conventional pitched battles. They had separate infantry, cavalry, and artillery arms, professional officers. Some even had uniforms. The insurgents had some early success. But as the Republican government began to devote some serious resources to suppress the rebellion, the Royalists were soon contained, and by the end of 1793, they began to suffer serious defeats. By 1794, the Vendeans had been mostly pushed underground, scattered into small bands, fighting as guerrillas. In February of 1795, the Republicans offered the surviving rebels amnesty in exchange for a few political concessions. Most of the rebel leadership accepted, and their men followed. So when Napoleon was offered a command in this theater in March of 1795, most of the action was over. Maybe at one time this had been a grand story, like the ones he read as a child about Caesar and Alexander, but it was now in its epilogue. All that remained for the armies in the Vendée was ugly work, maintaining order over a restive population, smoking out the rebel leaders who still held out, and fending off guerrilla attacks, what modern militaries refer to as counterinsurgency. These are often morally dubious tasks that call for uncompromising severity. As Napoleon himself put it, one cannot win glory fighting other Frenchmen. Furthermore, if he took the command, he would be serving in the infantry. Artillery was what Napoleon knew, where his expertise lay. Artillery was more than just a trade for Napoleon. As we've seen, he held a real passion for the subject. He considered the suggestion that he leave his specialty insulting. And perhaps worst of all, he would be under the command of General Lazare Hoche. Hoche was only a year older than Napoleon, and had risen through the ranks further and faster. In 1789, he'd been a lowly corporal, and now was a full general, commanding entire armies. Toulon had made Napoleon a minor celebrity within the army, but Hoche was a rock star. We've talked a few times about this class of young officers whose careers were made by the Revolution. Hoche was near the top of that class, maybe the valedictorian. A glory hound like Napoleon must have been jealous, and he was savvy enough to know that he could never outshine a man like Hoche. Lieutenant Marmont, Napoleon's friend and aide, called it, quote, a disastrous blow to Bonaparte's career, end quote. Everything about this assignment repelled Napoleon. Another type of man might have thought of his oath to the country, swallowed his pride, and reported to Brest. Not Napoleon. Instead, he left for Paris, to see if he could weasel his way out of the assignment. He arrived in the capital on May 25, 1795, along with a small entourage, including his young assistants, Junot and Marmont, and his younger brother, Louis, who had just turned 16, and Napoleon hoped to enroll in a military academy. Napoleon immediately called on the War Ministry to plead his case, but no one wanted to hear it. Brigadier General Bonaparte's preferences didn't carry the same weight they did before Thermidor. The army leadership was unequivocal. Either report to General Hoche or retire. Napoleon chose a third option, feigning illness. This came at a big financial cost. Officers claiming disability went on half pay until their cases could be evaluated. But apparently, being broke in Paris was preferable to service in the Vendée. He relied on charity from Joseph Bonaparte and Salicetti to make ends meet. The army was breathing down his neck to make a decision, go join General Hoche or formally retire. None of these options appealed to Napoleon in the slightest, so he stalled. Meanwhile, for the first time in years, he found himself with a great deal of free time. He explored the city, socialized, and took in the culture. It was far from his first visit to the city, but this was the period in which he really got to know Paris for the first time. Even today, Paris still bears the indelible stamp of Napoleon, but he didn't really have a sense of the place until he was already 26 years old and started on his path to fame. Just as it had in 1792, fate placed Napoleon in the capital at a moment of transition in the life of the city. The sudden political change of the Thermidor coup had sent aftershocks through the cultural and social life of Paris. Under the Jacobins, the cultural mood of the city had reflected the government's radical politics and Robespierre's puritanical moralism. Ostentatious displays of wealth were frowned upon in a time of patriotic self-sacrifice. There was social pressure to shun anything that might be construed as frivolous or wasteful in favor of the sober, serious, and civic-minded. Even in fashion, people eschewed the more formal styles associated with the aristocracy and adopted simpler clothing that was formerly associated with the working class. Ironically, Robespierre himself was quite a conservative dresser. By the time of his downfall, most men were wearing long pants and their hair free. Robespierre was one of the last prominent Parisians still clinging to his powdered white wig and breeches. Which makes sense given that he was also one of the few who wasn't under pressure to prove his revolutionary credentials. Women's clothing was transformed as well. The gigantic, opulent dresses and impossibly intricate hairstyles and makeup of the pre-revolutionary royal court were such potent symbols of aristocratic privilege and decadence that they remain iconic today. Unsurprisingly, they were rapidly abandoned with the revolution. When Napoleon arrived in Paris in 1795, the political changes we discussed last time had ended this mood of revolutionary austerity. The terror was over, and that sense of national emergency was fading away. The Thermidorians were not idealistic moralists like Robespierre. Far from it. Many of them had been motivated in part by personal corruption, so they were happy to indulge in a little luxury and frivolity. And so, as is often the case with cultural trends, the pendulum swung all the way the other direction. The upper classes once again felt comfortable showing off their wealth. People stopped feeling quite so guilty about attending lavish parties while men suffered and died at the front. Napoleon described this atmosphere in a letter to Joseph, quote, "The memory of the terror is no more than a nightmare. Everyone appears determined to make up for what they suffered. Determined, too, because of the uncertain future, not to miss a single pleasure of the present." End quote. Well-heeled Parisians socialized freely, without the fear that a new friend might make them guilty by association. Many Parisians were fatigued with endless political squabbling, war, and social upheaval, and hungry for a few hours of distraction from these daily struggles at the theater or the opera, ideally something with as few patriotic or political themes as possible. That pre-revolutionary decadence was slowly coming back, but different this time. Even luxury and frivolity were transformed by the revolution. With so much of the aristocracy dead or in exile, a new elite set the trends, the wealthy bourgeoisie. Men's breeches did make a bit of a comeback, but long pants had now become a permanent part of even upper-class men's wardrobes. The powdered wig was gone for good, only surviving as part of official dress codes in certain tradition-bound professions. Women did not return to the ponderously large gowns of the Golden Age of Versailles. In fact, women's dresses became smaller, much smaller. Scandalously small, according to conservative critics. Women's clothing was cut closer to the body, necklines were low, and transparent or nearly transparent materials were popular. We tend to think of everyone in the past as impossibly modest, even prudish, but that was not the case of Paris at the dawn of the 19th century. Within certain circles, at least, the scandalous clothing was matched by a degree of sexual freedom. Just like in politics and philosophy, both sexes modeled themselves after the Romans. White, toga-like dresses were popular for women, and men tried to comb their hair to look like statues of Caesar or Augustus. When they weren't wearing plain Roman white, both men and women favored gaudy, almost clownish, multicolored patterns. A subculture of outright fops and dandies emerged. The men were called incroyables, meaning incredibles, and the women were called merveilleuses, meaning marvelouses. You could identify them by their extra gaudy, colorful clothes and fussily coiffed hair. They were just the most extreme expressions of a wider culture that celebrated self-indulgence and sensual pleasure. Napoleon was not well suited to this indolent, decadent new climate. He was much more like old Robespierre. Austere by nature. He had never had the time or money to develop refined tastes in fashion, food, and drink. He loved a meaty intellectual debate, but felt awkward or bored when it came to light conversation or gossip, so he was often a gloomy presence at the famous Parisian salons. Napoleon was fundamentally a solemn, serious person. He could never totally fit in to a social scene that reveled in frivolity. One day during this period, Napoleon and Junot were out for a stroll and walked by a group of dandies. Napoleon turned to his friend and said, quote, "It is on such beings as these that fortune confers her favors. Good God, how contemptible is human nature." End quote. By most accounts, Napoleon cut an awkward figure, about as far as you can get from being a dandy. He was small. Slightly below average height, with a thin, wiry frame. He had a dark complexion, which must have been pronounced because a huge proportion of descriptions of him from this time mention it. But what would you expect of a person from Mediterranean descent who spent so much of his life outside? Now, thin and tan is considered quite desirable today, but in France in the 1790s, paleness was considered attractive. Some men even powdered their faces. And the ideal physique would probably look slightly doughy by our standards. He had thick black hair, which he wore long, almost shoulder length. This was a pretty popular style at the time, but it was usually tied back, especially on formal occasions, and Napoleon seems to have preferred to wear it loose. On duty, he wore the standard Republican general's uniform, a dark blue double-breasted jacket with long tails, white pants, tall boots, a black bicorn hat, and a sash in the colors of the revolutionary tricolor. Off duty, he was considerably less impressive. Laure d'Abrantes was a famous Parisian socialite who Napoleon knew around this time. She would later go on to marry Junot. Here's how she described Bonaparte during these months in Paris. Quote, "He was very careless of his personal appearance, and his hair, which was ill-combed and ill-powdered, gave him the look of a slob. When I recall Napoleon with his shabby round hat pulled over his forehead, and his ill-powdered hair hanging over the collar of his gray overcoat, which later became famous, without gloves because he used to say they were a useless luxury, with boots ill-made and ill-blacked, with his thinness and his sallow complexion. In short, when I recollect him at that time, and think of what he was afterwards, I do not see the same man in the two pictures." End quote. We should take that description with a grain of salt. First, Laure d'Abrantes' memoirs are notoriously elitist and acid-tongued. She was hard to impress and quick to criticize, especially when it came to style. And second, this is the opinion of a wealthy, cosmopolitan, bourgeois Parisian, a person who was right on the cutting edge of fashion trends. To a poor peasant, Napoleon probably looked like a rich, sophisticated gentleman. So, Napoleon was not exactly making a splash on the Paris social scene, at least not in a good way. For the rest of his life, he would despise parties and salons. But he wasn't a hermit. He did enjoy music, opera, and the theater, and he took advantage of his free time in the center of French culture by seeing as much as he could. After hearing that unflattering physical description, you will probably not be shocked to hear that the gaunt, shabby young Napoleon was not a huge hit with the ladies. It wasn't just his physique and dress. His sober, serious character didn't exactly scream romance. And he was often preoccupied with war and politics, subjects that were considered almost exclusively masculine in the 18th century. Napoleon never doubted his own abilities on the battlefield or in intellectual pursuits, but he does seem to have lacked confidence when it came to romance, and for good reason. After a lifetime in all-male boarding schools and in the army, he was awkward and naive when it came to matters of the heart. He had lost his virginity, but this was a fleeting experience, and one which he had paid for. That might be a little shocking to modern sensibilities, but it was quite common at the time, and didn't raise as many eyebrows as it does today. You might compare the buying and selling of sex in 18th century Paris to strip clubs or pornography today, officially considered immoral, or at least shameful, but more or less tolerated, as long as it remained on the margins of society. Napoleon considered it normal enough that he actually recorded the experience in his journal. It had been a spur-of-the-moment decision, which occurred when he was 18 years old. He was in Paris, walking home from the opera. Quote, "I felt the severity of the weather, and took refuge in the galleries. I was just entering the iron gates when my eyes became fixed on a person of the other sex. The time of night, her figure, and her youth left me in no doubt what her occupation was. I looked at her, she stopped, not with the impudent air common to her class, but in a manner that was quite in harmony with the charm of her appearance. This struck me. Her timidity encouraged me, and I spoke to her. I'll end the quotation there, so we don't lose our clean rating on iTunes. Before propositioning her, Napoleon peppered the poor young woman with questions, which I think speaks to his nervousness and insecurity. There had been other women in Napoleon's life, too, women of his own class with whom he struck up much less transactional relationships. As a teenager in Auxonne, he came to know Madame Colombier, a middle-aged bourgeois woman who took a liking to Napoleon and became a kind of surrogate mother. Now, there's no suggestion of anything romantic between them, but Napoleon did take a shine to her 18-year-old daughter, Caroline. She was almost 3 years older, but they went on a few dates, always closely chaperoned, adhering to the conventions of the time, and soon were sneaking off to meet in private. He later described their relationship, quote, "We were the most innocent creatures imaginable. We contrived little meetings together. I well remember one which took place on a midsummer morning, just as daylight began to dawn. It will scarcely be believed that all our happiness consisted of eating cherries together." End quote. Despite these little secret meetings, the relationship was chaste. Napoleon was too awkward and distant to act on whatever he might have been feeling. Ultimately, it would develop into a platonic friendship. Napoleon and Caroline continued to exchange letters long after he left Auxonne. Years later, Caroline fell on hard times. She appealed to Napoleon for help, and he appointed her lady-in-waiting to the Empress, and found her husband a job in the imperial administration. They were well-liked at court, and Napoleon remained fond of her until his death. Napoleon pursued other women in his late teens and early 20s, but never formed a connection as close to the one he had with Caroline Colombier. His type seems to have been slightly older and from rich or prominent families. It's possible he was just cynically trying to advance himself with a good marriage, but I think this is reflective of his lofty ambitions in a different way. Remember, Napoleon had been a big dreamer since childhood. Once he began to notice the opposite sex, it was only natural to look for a mate who matched his ambitions. Unfortunately for Napoleon, he didn't have much to offer these high society women. His salary wasn't particularly impressive, and his family's modest estates had all been seized by Paoli. The Bonaparte name might have meant something on Corsica, but they were nobodies on the mainland. He briefly became infatuated with an opera singer known as Madame de Saint-Huberti. He wrote her a few lines of poetry, but she paid him no mind. She was already deeply committed to an affair with the Count of Entraigues, a liberal nobleman who would soon betray the revolution to spy for the royalists, and get them both killed in the process. Maybe she should have read Napoleon's poem. There was also Émilie de Laurenti. Her father was a count, who found Napoleon too forward. Manesca Pilet was a wealthy heiress. She liked Napoleon, but her stepfather did not. Madame Permont was a wealthy widow, descended from the ancient Comnenus family, who had once been the ruling house of the Byzantine Empire. According to some sources, Napoleon proposed to her in 1795, when she was 40 and he was 26. Once she realized he was serious, she told him she was old enough to be his mother and turned him down. At least, so the story goes. During the campaigns of 1793 and 94, he carried on an affair with Louise Thoreau, wife of Louis Thoreau, one of the representatives on mission assigned to the army. Apparently, the Thoreaus did not have a great marriage, because a few years later, Representative Thoreau was murdered by a jealous husband. Depending on which sources you believe, by 1796, Napoleon had proposed to as many as 6 different women, and been rebuffed by all of them. There are a lot of colorful stories about Napoleon's love life, and it can be hard to know which to believe. This is an era in which people kept this part of their lives secret, separated from the face they showed the public. And once Napoleon reached fame, I think you can easily see how someone might have gotten a chuckle out of telling their friends a tall tale about turning down the Emperor of France when he was a poor, awkward young man. Even if not all of these stories are accurate, the general narrative that Napoleon was unlucky in love very much is. It seems the other adult Bonaparte brothers didn't have the same hang-ups. Lucien married Christine Boyer, an innkeeper's daughter he met through her sister, who was his housekeeper. According to 18th century social conventions, this was a poor match for Lucien. His new bride was far too working class. By some accounts, she couldn't even read. Some historians believe Lucien married Mademoiselle Boyer in a fit of youthful rebellion. It could also have been an expression of his radical, egalitarian political ideals. By now, Lucien was going by Brutus, taking on the name of a Roman tyrant slayer. And, of course, maybe they were simply in love. Joseph got married too. Unlike Lucien, he had made what was considered a good match, to Julie Clary, the daughter of a wealthy Marseille textile merchant. Julie was beautiful, elegant, and came from a good family. Her rich father provided a sizable dowry. Monsieur Clary had been skeptical of this family of trumped-up Corsican exiles, but Joseph's charm had won him over. Perhaps most importantly to our story, Julie had a younger sister, Desiree. Napoleon met her at the wedding and was instantly infatuated. He asked for permission to write to her, and she agreed. Much has been made of this romance between Napoleon and Desiree. It's by far the most famous of his early relationships, in large part because it was the subject of a best-selling novel in the 1950s, which was adapted into a Hollywood movie starring Marlon Brando as Napoleon. The truth is not terribly glamorous. Joseph and Julie were married on August 1st, 1794. No one at the wedding knew it yet, but the Thermidorian coup had already taken place in Paris. Napoleon would be in jail only days later. Shortly after that, he was back on campaign, then off to Paris, out of the region entirely. So this was a relationship carried out almost entirely by letter, not exactly the stuff of Hollywood romances. Desiree's parents were strongly against the match. "One Bonaparte in the family is enough," was supposedly her father's comment, and who can blame him? Perhaps under pressure from her family, or perhaps under her own volition, Desiree soon began to lose interest in Napoleon. After his arrival in Paris, her letters came less and less frequently. He pleaded with her, quote, "Adored friend, I have received no more letters from you. How could you go 11 days without writing to me?" End quote. He wrote to Joseph and begged him to intercede, but to no avail. To Napoleon's credit, once he finally accepted that Desiree was no longer interested, he handled the matter relatively gracefully. In August of 1795, almost exactly a year after they met, Napoleon wrote to her, quote, "If you meet someone to whom your heart warms, at the sight of whom your soul is moved and your reason yields, don't hold back. Love and be happy. You know that my destiny lies in the hazard of combat, in glory or in death." End quote. Maybe that's a little self-pitying at the end there, but I think that's relatively mature for someone who was generally so awkward in romance. When he wasn't annoying the ladies of Paris, Napoleon managed to keep himself busy, despite his supposed disability. He fantasized about leaving France, perhaps joining the private army of the British East India Company, or taking his skills to the Ottoman Empire, which was hiring foreign experts to reform its ailing military. Such drastic moves might revive his stalled career and satisfy his long-held fascination with the East, but he never followed through. As he often did when he was bored, Napoleon returned to writing. This time it was a doomed romance between an obvious Desiree stand-in and a character he clearly modeled on himself. Typical of Napoleon's fiction, it was an overwrought melodrama, derivative of better works. Still, he had a lot of free hours and not much to fill them. In August of 1795, the army issued an ultimatum. Napoleon was ordered either to present his disability claim before the Army Medical Board or go to the Vendée. No more stalling, no more extensions. Once again, Napoleon managed to weasel his way out and go with a third option. He leaned on his remaining political connections and got himself appointed to the Army Topographical Bureau in Paris. As you can probably guess from the name, the Topographical Bureau was responsible for providing maps to the armies. That may not sound like much, but under its unassuming exterior, the Topographical Bureau was a critically important institution. For starters, finding good maps of foreign territory was a real challenge. Today, we can pick up any type of atlas at a bookstore or online, but in the 18th century, detailed maps were often closely guarded state or commercial secrets. But more important than the maps themselves, the Topographic Bureau functioned as a kind of proto-general staff for the French army. If you're not familiar with the term, a general staff is sort of like a central administrative bureaucracy of a military. They manage things like logistics, finances, information, organization, and most importantly, strategic planning. If the military was a body, the general staff would be its brain. All modern armies have them, but the concept was in its infancy in Napoleon's day. Obviously, all militaries have always had to undertake those functions, but the idea of having a permanent, professional group of officers specially trained for staff duties was relatively new. It was first pioneered by the Austrians, in the wake of their defeats at the beginning of the Seven Years' War, shortly before Napoleon was born. The French army had just started to create its own general staff when the revolution broke out, but the new revolutionary government disbanded it. They were skeptical of anything tied to the old royal army, and desperately needed officers elsewhere. Not everyone agreed with this decision. In particular, Lazare Carnot, the radical military theorist who was now running the Republic's war effort. He believed France desperately needed a general staff to properly manage these massive new armies, all fighting on different fronts. But this was France in the 1790s. Standing against consensus was a good way to find yourself under the guillotine. So, instead of fighting to save the general staff, Carnot quietly packed the Topographic Bureau with his protégés, and assigned it many of the functions of a general staff. It was a good fit because they already controlled the maps. If some French general along the Rhine River was planning an offensive, he'd request maps of Western Germany from the Topographic Bureau. When they arrived, he'd find them already marked with quote-unquote suggestions from Paris. How and when to move his troops, where to place supply depots, where to watch for probable enemy counterattacks, etc. And these suggestions were usually very good. From their office in Paris, surrounded by maps and reports from every French army and government ministry, the men of the Topographic Bureau could see the big picture, get a bird's-eye view of France's entire strategic situation in a way that the generals on the ground often could not. Carnot used his influence to place many of the best young minds of the French army in this office. The men of the Topographic Bureau were known as topos, and had a reputation within the army as sage-like eggheads. Their work was not glamorous. From a certain perspective, they were clerks in uniform more than true soldiers. But as war became more scientific, more of a contest of national resources and organization than a matter of heroism or chivalry, these were the types of tasks that increasingly made the difference between victory and defeat. The French Topographic Bureau excelled at them beyond anyone in the world. Napoleon wasn't one of Carnot's hand-picked apprentices. The Topographic Bureau was a refuge from his assignment in the Vendée. It had never been his ambition to take a job so far from the battlefield. Nevertheless, he immediately took to it. As we've seen, he had a good mind for this type of work. Napoleon was a detail-oriented person who understood the importance of mundane issues like supply and organization. Even when he was at the front, he always had one eye on the bigger picture. It was that big-picture perspective that made his plans at Toulon and Saorgio so effective. These were exactly the types of skills the planners at the Topographic Bureau needed. He fit right in. Carnot was impressed. Along with his day-to-day duties as a topo, he took on a personal project. As you might recall from episode 19, During his time fighting in the Alps, Napoleon became convinced that France should invade northern Italy. Conventional wisdom was that this was a secondary theater of war. Italy was too far from the Austrian heartland, and the terrain was too rough and defensible. And so, it was believed France should devote no more than the bare minimum forces required to protect her own interests in the region. Napoleon believed conventional wisdom was wrong. Italy was an under-defended back door to Austria. With the right tactics, an aggressive attacker could actually use the rough terrain to his advantage, seize the wealthy provinces of northern Italy, and be at Vienna's doorstep before the Habsburgs had time to react. He had managed to convince the Robespierre brothers of this course of action, but now they were gone, and the plan had no real advocates within the government. However, part of the purpose of the Topographic Bureau was planning out theoretical future military operations. So, Napoleon set to work refining and improving this idea for a lightning offensive through northern Italy. While Napoleon busied himself with maps, across town, the convention was working on a new constitution. The Thermidorians, who controlled the government, were revolutionaries, but they were also moderates, cynical realists rather than idealistic radicals. Their goals in drafting the constitution were preserving their own power and preventing the type of civil disorder that had torn France apart for the last few years. Safeguarding liberty, fostering democracy, or uplifting the common people were nothing more than an afterthought, window dressing on a fundamentally authoritarian, elitist system. On August 22, 1795, the convention published the final draft of a new constitution. That's day 5 of the month of Fructidor, year 3 under the revolutionary calendar, which is why this document is known to history as the Constitution of Year 3. This was not a conservative document. France would remain a secular republic, with elections and a deliberative legislature. Much like the American Constitution, it began with an expansive Bill of Rights. However, this certainly wasn't a radical constitution either. Voting would be tightly restricted, based on sex, age, and income. Probably under 20% of the population would qualify. The executive branch would be a 5-man commission, known as the Directory, which had sweeping powers, particularly in cases of national emergency. There would be elections, but no position of national importance was actually directly elected. The people voted for electors, who would then choose the members of the legislature from among themselves, and then the legislature would choose the directors from among themselves. You have to hand it to them, it was a clever way to give some appearance of democracy, while ensuring that all decisions would be made by the political elite. A national referendum on the Constitution was scheduled for September 6th. Again, a clever way to appear democratic while stacking the deck in favor of the government. This would be a simple yes or no vote. People would be given no alternative to the proposed Constitution. So the options were giving the country a defined system of government, however imperfect, or continuing with the political chaos. So the referendum was a bit of a foregone conclusion. But I think we'll leave things there anyway, despite the lack of a good cliffhanger. Next time, we may depart from the narrative a bit and do a special topic-based episode. I haven't decided yet. Until then, thanks for listening.